Barbara Baker, Vice Chair of the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, calling the meeting of June 26th to order. This is a webinar. We used to call these conference calls. It'll be a shorter version of our almost monthly commission meetings. So we hope to get going and get our business transacted expediently. Everybody looks very kind of concerned today, so I hope we can also do it in a civil and almost, enjoyable goes too far, but we're gonna get through this this meeting. So before we carry on with the agenda, is there any areas of interest or comments that commissioners or staff would like to make?
Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I had a constituent call me this week with a question about the closure of the boat launch down at Hoodsport. Apparently there is a boat launch, kind of the parking lot has been closed. And I believe it's on Skokomish Reservation property, but yet it's been in use for a long time. Very popular launching spot. There aren't a lot of launches in that part of Hood Canal. So just wondering, Director, if you've heard anything about that, or maybe I could request a status update so I could let this constituent know.
Yeah, but we can follow up a little more, but I believe they're talking about the boat launch that actually was transferred to the tribe, and so it's a tribally owned launch and controlled launch, and the tribe has closed access to it, or at least they had the last I'd heard.
Okay. So, I'm just curious if it's going to remain closed indefinitely, or if it's a short-term COVID-19 related type thing. I'd like to get back to constituents and let them know what's going on.
And we can check in with the tribe too. It was closed as a matter of their concerns over COVID and gathering at that launch. It's a very popular launch. I don't know that they have a projected opening date, but we could check to see if they do.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other pressing concerns from commissioners or staff? Well, hearing none, I should note, instead of taking roll, this makes it easy to be able to see all your faces. So present are Commissioner Kehoe, Commissioner Thorburn, Commissioner Carpenter, Graybill, myself, McIsaac, and Smith. We have not seen yet Commissioner Linville. She may or may not be able to join, and Commissioner Anderson will not be here today. So with that, I think we should get right into it and go to agenda item one, which is a petition for rulemaking regarding lethal control of wolves. Is that, Donnie, are you taking the lead on that, or whomever is? Go for it.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chair, Vice Chair, Commissioners, Director, Deputy Director. My name is Donnie Martorello. I'm the Wolf Policy Lead for Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'll take us through a presentation related to the petition and then be available for any questions. I'm going to share my screen here in a moment. Real quickly, if I've got good signal strength right now, But if you don't hear me, Tess will speak up, and I will grab the laptop and run from the garage closer to the router and jump back in. So just a heads up on that.
So Donnie, if commissioners have questions or comments, I believe we all understand that we need to raise our hand now. Do you prefer to go through your presentation and take comments at the end, or as we go along?
Just for the flow here, I'd prefer to get to the end and then field your questions. And then does that work for you?
Well, it works for me, and I'm going to suggest that it works for the rest of us unless we have some burning desire to interrupt you, in which case we never miss that opportunity.
Okay. Can you see my the first slide of my presentation on your screen?
Yes.
I can. Yep.
Okay. And then one other item is I've got two screens here in my garage, and so I've got the presentation in front of me at eye level, and then I've got your face is higher. So if you see me looking up, I'm looking at your faces. I'm not, just so you know that. Okay, so good morning. I'm going to go over the department's recommendation for the petition that you all received. Real quick, I just wanted to acknowledge the four petitioners. There was an error on my part in the summary sheet. The petitioners are the Center for Biological Diversity, Cascadia Wildlands, Western Watersheds Project, and Wild Earth Guardians. It does not include the Western Environmental Law Center. I'm going to go through, just for the record here, some quick items to serve this up. I think all of you know this, and many of the public that are listening in. In terms of Washington State, we have a complicated listing status. Eastern third of the state that you see here on the screen is federally delisted. The western two-thirds of the state is federally listed under ESA, and the entire state is state-listed as endangered. So what does that mean in terms of conflict in this situation that we're talking about in terms of the petition? That the agency has lethal removal authority in the federally delisted portion of the state, so that eastern third. Neither the state or U.S. Fish and Wildlife have the authority to lethal remove a wolf for livestock depredation reasons in the western two-thirds. I think you're all familiar with the goals of the wolf plan. Of course, our wolf plan is our guidance document, and we're going to be homing in on that second objective here, our goal here, to minimize wolf livestock conflict. Our first pack, as you know, was in 2008. Now we have about 26 or so packs statewide. We've seen a progression each year since that first pack in 2008 to what we have today. In terms of the number of wolves, and you, I think, saw this in our annual report, the number of wolves that are on department jurisdictions at a minimum count of 108 wolves in 21 different packs. And then in that portion of the Colville Reservation, the Confederate tribes of the Colville Reservation counted 37 wolves in five packs, so a total of that 26 known packs. And I just want to emphasize, as you all have heard me say in the past, that these are minimums. There are more than that. There are more packs and there are more wolves. These are just what we see. And this equates to about an average annual growth rate of 23%. Now, in terms of this issue of wolf-livestock conflict, we have a large enough population now that we see conflict each year. And I think I think we're on that path now, where each year we'll have some level of conflict. And if you look here at the bar graph, the yellow is the number of packs, the hashed darker color is a number of depredating packs. And, you know, in that range from 2012 to 2019, it's about three or four packs a year are involved in conflict. And now a smaller portion of those are involved in conflict that escalates to the level of needing, of warranting lethal removal, a decision by the director. Now, many of you have heard me say that compare this to the Northern Rocky Mountain ecosystem that has had wolves for decades before us. And they tend to see, and what they report and kind of been coined by them, is on average about 80% of the packs on the landscape are not involved in conflict, and about 20% are. We're doing a bit better than that. On average, about 85% of our packs are not involved in conflict, and about 15% are. And so, you know, our goal, as you know, is from the plan is to try to minimize that and improve that ratio as much as we possibly can. So I'm going to walk through part of this presentation to share with you the guidance of the plan. And so this is, I've taken, we often refer to a paragraph of the plan. It's page 88, and it gives us that direct guidance on how to think about wolf livestock conflict, and in particular, non-lethal and lethal tools. And so I've taken that paragraph and I broke it into phrases, and you'll see why in later slides I've done that. I'm going to quickly walk through those. So that on page 88 in that paragraph, the title is Lethal Control to Resolve Repeated Livestock Depredations. It says lethal removal may be used to stop repeated depredations. Livestock have been clearly killed by wolves. Non-lethal methods have been tried but failed to resolve conflict. Depredations are likely to continue. There is no evidence of intentional feeding or unnatural attraction of wolves by the livestock owner. The situations will have to be evaluated on a case-specific basis. And management decisions are based on pack history and size, pattern of depredations, number of livestock killed, the state listed status, of course, the extent of the proactive management measures being used on the property, and other considerations. So I'll come back to this in a moment, but I'm going to switch gears to kind of what have we done to prepare for this and to address this. So one of the first items, of course, is getting that expertise within the agency. So one of the first things we did when the completion of the plan was the start of a build out. So we created a conflict section within the wildlife program. We hired 16 or more than that, but you'll see on here, this is a map of our staff that have a significant portion of their job duties are wolf related. And I know you can't dial in and look at all this, but just giving you a sense of what this looks like. We have 16 wildlife conflict specialists that are deployed strategically around the state. They are that conduit, that first line of response to work with livestock producers to both try to proactively address conflict, to minimize conflict from ever happening through proactive non-lethal tools, but also to be that face of the agency and work and have a relationship with producers and part of their communities. It also includes some build out of our enforcement staff in several years ago, where we added additional enforcement staff in Northeastern Washington. Here just a couple years ago, we added more conflict specialists to Northeastern Washington. And then of course there's team members that are, we have three dedicated wolf biologists and then many other folks that are on this map. The next major component here that I like to highlight is the non-lethal tool. So think of this as a toolbox where we have a number of non-lethal tools and lethal in that toolbox. And one of the ways that we get those tools out there, they're available for livestock producers. We have a stockpile of equipment, but we also have what's called a cost share contract. We call it the Damage Prevention Cooperative Agreement for Livestock Producers. And that is a way for us to offset some of the cost for a producer to implement some of the non-lethal tools. Some of them have a cost and some of them don't. And I'm not going to go through the entire list here, but you can see the various non-lethal tools, and this is not exhaustive. This is just a short list of those. And one of the things I want to highlight is these tools just don't work for any operation. You have to pick the tool that is most suitable for that particular livestock operation. So but it depends on the type of livestock, the age of those livestock in some cases, whether it's, is that dispersed grazing, is it behind a fence, all those variables that are specific to that operation. And then the producer working alongside with a wildlife conflict specialist kind of looks through and says, oh, we think these tools would be best for your particular operation. And what you see here as an example is, this is Fladry around a small flock of sheep and a livestock guardian dog. And even that is very, is tailored to that particular operation. A livestock guardian dog is just not any dog. It's a dog that is raised with the sheep and is trained and et cetera. Fladry doesn't work in all landscapes and environments. It's best in this kind of environment that is open and you can see the entire flock in one glance. So just wanted to give you a flavor for those tools and how site-specific and producer-specific or operation-specific they are. One of the tools that I want to talk a little bit more about is range riding. Range riding has got a lot of attention in the recent years. I remember when we first started out in this, we didn't have range riding in the state. We've had it now for several years, and it's growing. I think momentum is growing, and the use is growing for sure. So range riding is essentially, and range riders do a lot. So I'm gonna make a statement that's gonna oversimplify, but they're essentially out there and they're providing regular monitoring of livestock. And while they're doing that, they have an awareness around them for wolf sign and other carnivore sign, and they're looking for injuries on livestock and all of those kinds of things. But they're out there on a daily or near daily basis monitoring the livestock so that they can detect changes in cattle behavior or are cows in the wrong spot or, you know, are there anybody limping or any of those kinds of things. And along, like I said, along with, are you hearing howling? Are you seeing wolf tracks? The range riding program has been growing. This is something we're feeling very optimistic about. Is we've started with a very small program by one nonprofit, Conservation Northwest, and some early range riding by the department. And now that has grown to a range riding program that includes multiple entities, including some producers hire and range riders on their own. Some producers use the cost share contracts I talked about to help offset the cost of hiring a range rider. There are specific department contracted range riders. We have about, and it ranges anywhere from, you know, 8 or 9 to 14 or 15 range riders in a particular year. There are range riding services now provided by 3 nonprofit entities. It includes it's called NUC, Northeastern Washington Cattle Collaborative, the cattle producers, the Washington Kapow, and Conservation Northwest. And so that's a good thing because now producers have multiple entities that they can say, what works best for me? One of the last major components, there are many that you see on the summary sheet. I don't have time today to go through all of those. But one of the last ones I wanted to talk about was our compensation program. This also plays a part in our goal of our plan in this issue of wolf livestock conflict. You know, we have, as you know, we have a compensation program for both direct losses or damages by wolves, whether that's an injury to a livestock or a death. And then we have indirect, and you can see here on the screen, those kinds of things are greater than normal losses, reduced pregnancy rates, reduced weight gain. And then we've also established a livestock review board that for indirect claims that reviews that packet for us and gives us a recommendation on how to move on it. Now, this is one that is in rule. And, you know, I'd be remiss not to mention that this is working. When I say it's working, it's being used. But you've heard me say before, and we're right in a process right now of trying to improve this. I think it could be used more by livestock producers. And I believe that that would be in the best interest of both producer community, environmental community, and the department community. So right now we're working with a small stakeholder group on the indirect process. It's a little bit stalled out just with busy work schedules and this COVID-19 situation, but that's something we're committed to and you'll be seeing on the horizon is potentially some rule changes or recommendations for the indirect compensation program. Now, this is just a snapshot of the dollars spent in the 2017-19 biennium that were associated with either the toolbox, either non-lethal or lethal. And the reason that I wanted to show this is a couple reasons is that, you know, the department approaches this conundrum of conflict from a proactive non-lethal standpoint first. We tried to prevent the conflict from ever happening by getting the proactive non-lethal tools out on the landscape. If there is conflict, we think about what kind of responsive deterrent measures could be put in place. And really the lethal side of this is the tool of last resort. And I think that our spending reflects that, where you see, now this changes year to year or biennium to biennium, so it can go up or down, but the pattern is the same. Where in this particular biennium, you see about 89% towards the non-lethal side and about 11% towards the lethal side. Now, in years when there's more lethal removal, that piece of the pie does get bigger, but it doesn't swamp the other ones like what you see here. It's a much smaller piece of the pie in terms of all the dollars that go into this toolbox. So I'm back to my list of phrases that the guidance from the paragraph in the Wolf Plan that I walked through a minute ago. And so one of the things as we go to implement that plan, the question is, so what do these phrases mean? What does repeated depredations mean? What does clearly killed by wolves mean? What non-lethal deterrent methods, et cetera, the items you see there in bold. Now the plan is meant to have adaptability and flexibility built into it, knowing that every case of conflict is unique and it's its own set of facts. But we still need a little more understanding about what this paragraph in the plan means. So the plan actually helps us with that. I'm going to quickly read this. This is from the goals, objectives, and strategies and tasks section on page 159 of the plan. And it says, a citizen advisory group will be formed to provide feedback to WDFW on implementation of the conservation management plan. Aspects addressed might include wolf conservation activities, depredation control activities, the impacts of outreach education, reviewing problems, and determining needs for new adaptive management procedures. Membership of this advisory group should include a balanced representation of the range of stakeholder values regarding wolf establishment in Washington. So that's what the department, that's the direction the department has taken for addressing wolf livestock conflict. As you all know, this is a extremely controversial subject, very polarized with little or no middle ground. And so we were tasked, what we did is established a wolf advisory group and brought those players into a process. Now, you've heard me talk about, given the controversial nature of this, that process in the beginning was very, very rocky. Around 2015, a little earlier than that, in 2014, we reached out to an expert in the social conflict arena. You all have heard us talk about her or met her, know her, Francine Madden. And she came to us with that social conflict expertise and did an assessment and said how that really helped us understand how can we do a better job at of implementing that portion of the plan and using a citizen-based form to help us guide us a bit more. In 2015, we revamped the Wolf Advisory Group to an 18-member group that has a cross-section of environmentalists, hunters, livestock producers, and then the department is also there. And this, the WAG started weighing into these issues. Now, it's not that, as you all know, it's not that simple as just pulling together an advisory group. In a moment here, I'll talk about the kind of the conflict that we're dealing with. But I'll just say that this process is time intensive, that there are, we're bringing together very diverse perspectives, that polar extremes, if you will, and putting them in a room and asking them to help guide the department in implementation of the plan. And there's, for every hour of, I think, of working together in the room, there's probably 10 hours or more outside of that, preparing for that and getting folks in a position where they can be there and it's productive and all those kinds of things. And the reason why, and this will come, this will make sense to you in a moment, probably does already, as I tie this together at the end. But the reason why is, as I mentioned, we are pulling together these very, for these very diverse entities, you know, different cultures. And the best way to describe that, Francine describes this as a level of levels of conflict. And I'm going to use a example that she uses. I don't do it nearly as well, but she describes it as kind of this volcano, if you will, this triangle, where at the first level there's a dispute, next level down underlying conflict, and then the bottom level identity based or root or identity or deep rooted conflict. Now, the way to think about a dispute, and this is her example, is imagine that there's a car wreck, and what do we all do? You get out of your car and you pull out your insurance card and you go exchange it with the other person, and you don't know that person. So there's no history of conflict there. And it's a normal dispute process, which is a settlement process of going to court maybe and finding out who's at fault and all those kinds of things. Now imagine that same car wreck, but it's a couple that just went through a really, really nasty divorce. Is that context different? Of course it is, because they have history of this nasty divorce that enters this dispute of the car wreck. And so of course that makes it more complex and more challenging to deal with that dispute of the car wreck because of that history. Now imagine that same car wreck, and I'm going to go to the identity-based or deep-rooted conflict level. I'll put this in the context of the Bosnian War, where you had Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks each had their own license plate that could identify who they were. It's the day after peace was declared, and imagine that same car wreck now, when the two folks get out of the car and they don't know each other, but they look over and one's a Serb and one's a Croat. Now, does that change the context of that dispute? And of course it does, because of that deep-rooted identity base. They see each other as identities and not as individuals. And so that is in Francine Madden's assessment of our situation, conflict in the state, we have identity-based deep-rooted conflict. You know, to put more of a tip on it, you know, when you bring those very different cultures together, and they don't know each other, is there identity-based conflict when one's wearing a cowboy hat and one's wearing a North Face jacket? And you can play the examples. Is one from the east side or one from the west side, and all the other different identities that are out there? So the department took the path of trying to address that deep-rooted identity-based, deep-rooted or identity-based conflict first. And we did that through capacity building and conflict transformation process led by Francine. Now, this is all working towards this conundrum that we have with wolf livestock conflict. But if you don't address that that underlining conflict or those base layers of conflict first, then your product will not be very lasting. You'll have to redo, and redo. And we went through that in the early years of the Wolf Advisor Group. So you first have to, you know, reconcile those past relationships to get people in a place where they can actually work on this very difficult subject. You have to develop a process that they own for how they make decisions and ground rules and how they move through their content before you ever get to that content. Okay, so I'm going to bring this home now. So, you know, you have a petition for rulemaking in front of you. And I want to compare, you know, standard processes that we use versus this process that the department's used, this conflict transformation process on this wolf livestock conflict issue. Now, when I compare these, I'm not saying one's good or one's bad. They're just different, and they apply to different kinds of situations. So our standard process, whether it's developing a plan or a commission action, those kinds of things, built on products like plans and rules and those kinds of things. It's usually stakeholders speaking to the department, speaking to the commission, speaking to the director. It typically is a point-counterpoint dialogue. It can be destructive if there is this deep-rooted or identity-based conflict because people's needs are not met. If that is the case, then you don't see this real high cohesion. You see these really tough issues have really low cohesion under that kind of process, and you see what is coined the weapons of the week, foot dragging, poaching, all those other things that are acted out when a person, when an identity's needs are not met. Now I'm going to compare that to this longer process, this process built on relationships, where you reconcile those relationships first before you get to that content. So it's a go slow to go fast. You've seen that in the Wolf Advisor Group. It's, as I said, reconciling relationships and making it so folks don't see each other as identities, but as people. It's stakeholders working together. You've all seen the Wolf Advisor Group and the U working together. That it tends to be a more constructive process when you have deep-rooted identity-based conflict to create these creative solutions like the protocol for tackling this issue. So again, wrapping this up here pretty quick. So the Wolf Advisor Group has produced a what's currently being used is our 2017 Wolf Livestock Interactions Protocol. They reached a consensus on this very, very challenging issue. It's the one that you have in front of you in terms of considering for rulemaking. And it's meant to provide some consistency and clarity to that paragraph that I mentioned a moment ago. I'll get to that just here in a moment. So let me back up and give a little history of what that protocol history has been. So we started with a department-derived protocol in 2013-2015 time period. We had that was the early days of our WAG where we had about 8 or 9 members, and you saw and we didn't invest this time that we just talked about, and you saw real low cohesion, real low stakeholder support, and the protocol didn't last. It was not durable. We went through this process that I talked about with the Wolf Advisor Group. The Wolf Advisor Group in the next year produced our next version of our protocol where they had complete consensus on it and supported the process. Now, when I say they supported the process, it doesn't mean they support the decisions that come from it. They support the process they did to derive that recommendation to the director. And then it's up to the agency and the director to make decisions. The protocol is a guidance document. It's a non-binding guidance document. And so when I say support, it's not necessarily in each individual decision. They're all different, but it's in the process that they had to create that. And then, of course, I just talked about they created the 2017 protocol, so revision from their 2016. I'm going to add also that I wouldn't have thought many years ago that we would have that level of cohesion and support in the process that we did in 2016 protocol and 2017. I didn't think it was attainable back in the day, but it has been. And WAG right now is currently working on another revision. They've been working on it for a while. This is very tough stuff, as you all know. The content's very tough, but you're seeing a process that where they are able to, with all the challenges that they have and frustrations that are real, they're still there at the table and they're still working on it, which is a good thing. Okay, so remember that paragraph that I had broken up into phrases, and I'm not going to read all through this or anything, but on the left-hand side are those phrases in the top table, and on the right-hand side are the recommendations is the elements from the 2017 protocol. So these were recommendations from WAG to the director. I'll just give you an idea. So here is now, as I mentioned, the way I phrase it is the plan gives us that overarching guidance, but let's unpack that a little bit more. What does stop depredations mean? Well, the protocol provides guidance again. It's not rule or law, guidance. Well, repeated depredation means at least 3 depredation events in 30-day rolling window or 4 in a 10-month rolling window. So now the director and the public have a little more, the director has a little more guidance, and the public has a little more clarity and understanding what repeated depredations mean. Same is true. What does a documented depredation mean? Well, that's one that's we investigate the depredation by our trained staff and determine whether it's a confirmed wolf depredation or a probable or unknown. What does non-lethal methods that have been tried and failed mean? Well, the protocol provides the guidance that that's at least 2 proactive deterrent measures. and responsive deterrent measures that have been implemented and failed to meet the goal of the protocol or the plan. So again, it unpacks that paragraph in the plan, kind of phrase by phrase. Now, to a little bit of the reactions to the petition. I'm not going to go over the handout that I provided to you. You have that, and so does the public. Just wanted to mention that we didn't believe that there were elements of the recommendation that we didn't believe were appropriate for rule, and were either already being addressed or too subjective. And I want to give you a flavor of that. So things like that's in the proposed rule of requiring department staff to work with every producer. We simply don't have the staff capacity to actually work with every single producer out there on a regular basis. There are too many of them and too few of us. And so we prioritize, we work with those that are on the landscapes that we think are gonna be the highest likelihood for conflict. So those producers that operate livestock on private, but also on public land. So for example, federal grazing allotments, producers that have had conflict in the past, producers that overlap, core areas of wolf packs. And so that one felt that we would need a lot more staff resources to be able to achieve that. Another example would be, requirements that the department actually does the non-lethal deterrence. Livestock husbandry is really not in our wheelhouse. That's not our expertise. We do some of that now as we are all adjusting to wolves on the landscape and working with producers. But in the long run, actually the department doing the husbandry practices like range riders, that's really not in our wheelhouse, and in the long run probably belongs somewhere else. A couple of things are pretty subjective in the draft recommendation, or the recommendation on the petition. Things like must make sure there's adequate number of range riders on these federal allotments. Again, that's a pretty tough one. What does adequate mean? We need some flexibility or some adaptability around that. Things like spending enough time, that range riders are spending enough time. What does that really mean? Are the techniques appropriate for an operation? We do that now, but in rule, what does that mean? What would appropriate mean? Why have non-lethals failed? That's another item that's in the proposed rule. Pretty subjective. It'd be hard to understand that in a rule context. There are a couple things in the petition that are just, we have no authority to do. Things like relocating livestock or moving livestock. Those are the private property of producers, and we simply don't have the legal authority to move somebody's personal property. Just want to touch real quickly on, to give you you saw on the list in the summary sheet of the items that are kind of major elements of our program, but I wanted to give you a sense of some of the things that we've done more recently. So we've recently started the periodic status review that is in process right now with the commission process. We've initiated the SEPA and EIS process for the post-recovery wolf plan. We've worked with the legislature recently and Washington State Department of Agriculture on a new grant program for non-lethal tools to get those out in the landscape. That's been in the last 2 years. In the last year or a couple years, we're improving the accountability of contracted services. That's for range riders and DPCALs, so improvements there. We are working more, better communication with the Forest Service, both at the ground level and at higher levels. We are always working to try to improve the range riding process or that service. We are now implementing our outfitting all of our range riders with those in-reach devices so that they can text us from anywhere. We can trade text back and forth and know what they're seeing or if there's issues or concerns or safety concerns. And then, as I said, we're currently working on revisions to the 2017 protocol. And then one item I wanted to call out from that specifically is the WAG and the department is really weighing in heavily on refining the expectations and accountability of range riding, knowing that that is one of the best tools when livestock are in dispersed grazing on allotment type settings. So our recommendation to you is to deny the petition based on, we believe that determining the need for the use of lethal removal to stop repeated depredations is a very complicated issue. Eliminating the flexibility articulated in the plan and in the protocol reduces our ability in the case-specific uniqueness of this. The proposed rule has some problems, those that I just talked about. Some things that are not in our wheelhouse, some things that are very subjective, some things are out of our capacity without additional funds. The issue of wolf management and removals involves internal department actions and internal practices that are not legally required to be set in rule, nor is it normal to set the same out in rule. I spent much of this presentation talking about, the department's WAG process involves significantly more time to address the issues that need to be addressed in this very difficult and polarizing environment that we're in, compared to, I think, the process that's provided through a rulemaking. And again, not saying that that's bad, different level of conflict here, and we believe that that more involved process with stakeholders and WAG is a better fit than the rulemaking process. And as I alluded to, if the proposed rule was adopted, the department would need to hire significantly more conflict specialists to meet at least those requirements that are proposed. That's likely not feasible given the state's current budget uncertainty. And then lastly, late in the day yesterday, you got some supplemental materials. I just wanted to acknowledge those. It was the department's annual wolf reports from 2011 to 2019. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife reports for the same time period. And just wanted to acknowledge that we're aware, of course, of both of those sets of reports and have read those and, you know, obviously ours we created. And so nothing new there that we weren't aware of. And then they also provided three declarations from a past injunction hearing last August. Again, aware of those, and nothing new for this in terms of things we weren't aware of. So with that, I hope that wasn't too long and available for questions.
Does anybody have questions for Donnie? Let me see. Feel free Don. To
let Don and then Kim.
Okay, yeah, it's hard for me to monitor that. So, Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes, thank you, Madam Vice Chair. On slide 32, you talk about the supplemental materials that we got kind of late in the ball game here. But when you hear someone say, well, there's a substantial difference between the performance at the policy level in Oregon and Washington, and that it might be due to the rulemaking aspect in Oregon versus not having the rulemaking aspect in Washington. When you look at the data sets of those and you compare the numbers there, what things come to your mind to explain the difference, or would you assign all of it to just the matter of having rulemaking?
Good question. No, I wouldn't assign it to the matter of rulemaking or not rulemaking. There are many differences, I think there are many, many variables, only some of which we have knowledge about. But what I've learned is that every case is unique. With conflict is going to begin, whether it's in rule or not in rule doesn't change that. The big elements are, you know, how many wolves and how many livestock and what's the level of overlap. And then we have the tools that we have to try to address that, whether that's non-lethal or lethal. The tools that we have, none of them will guarantee there's no conflict. And so, you do your best to try to minimize it in the beginning. I think we have compared to any state, I think we have a great program and a great track record of that. And as I said, lethal removal at the last resort, but I don't believe that, and I allow others to weigh in as well, but I don't believe that that rulemaking or not rulemaking or having a protocol is the answer to less conflict. I think it is applying the tools that we have on the ground.
What would you account for the differences between Oregon and Washington as things that could influence the difference?
I think it's the cooperation between the producer and the staff that are in both states that are working to implement non-lethal tools on the landscape. I think it's the amount of overlap. In Washington, nearly all of our packs, but a couple overlap core grazing areas. I think those are the big ones. I think I don't know that I'm giving you great answers here because there are so many factors and variables involved. I couldn't begin to tell you what captures all that variability. The only other thing I could share would be that from a lethal removal standpoint, whether regardless of the state, regardless of the in rule or in protocol, it's not a tool that solves the conflict. It's a tool that buys you time. It delays until there's more conflict. So it's, as I said, none of the tools really take the probability to zero.
Thank you.
You bet.
So, Commissioner Thorburn, did you have a question or comment?
I actually waited to raise my hand. If there are no other questions, I'm prepared to make a motion.
Are there any other questions? Is there any other discussion before we go to a motion? Well, in that case, go ahead, Commissioner Thorburn.
Okay, I will make my motion. If there's a second, I'd then like to discuss the motion. And I will move to deny the petition.
Is there a second?
McIsaac, second.
Sure.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we deny the petition for rulemaking that's under consideration at this point. There will be discussion on this motion, beginning with Commissioner Thorburn.
Thank you. Thank you, Donnie, for the comprehensive presentation. I think it was an important review for all of us. I want to start by saying, speaking for myself as a commissioner and hopefully for other members of the commission, we are well aware of the challenges of wolf management and support the work of the department, in particular in this very challenging area of a wolf-livestock conflict. We follow the work closely. We have annual reports. We now have a wolf subcommittee that gets even more detailed information about the management of wolves and the challenges that the department faces. Donnie emphasized the process that went into the development of the protocol that guides wolf conflict management and emphasizes what we all support, which is the need for non-lethal deterrence attempts. We, I think, as a commission, recognize that this is in statute and support all of this work. We also recognize that non-lethal deterrence, as Donnie just mentioned, is never 100%. And anyone who lives in rural communities who deals with livestock on their property knows that you can't always guarantee that deer are going to be kept out of the garden or raccoons out of your chicken coop. And it's the same with trying to keep wolves off of livestock. What was really not emphasized a lot in the presentation, and what I want to draw out in my reason for supporting a denial of rulemaking, is all of the effort that goes into working with the communities that are most impacted by wolves on the landscape. It is absolutely essential that we have staff on the ground working with individuals and communities and building those communities so that they have a sense of security with living with wolves, that their communities and livelihoods are going to be safe and protected. And that really has to be done on a case-by-case basis. All of that community building, I think the slide that most demonstrated that was early in the presentation, where Donnie showed all of the staff who were involved in wolf management in the state. And if you look at Northeast Washington, the number of conflict specialists and the number of enforcement officers, these are the folks on the ground who are day by day out working with the communities. I'm going to turn off my video, but are out there working the individuals who are impacted. This really has to be case by case, and rules take away that kind of flexibility. And that's what I'm so supportive of, and the reason that I'm making the motion to deny this petition.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. My computer does not let me get to the participants list, so I can't see who has their hands raised. So Tess or Nikki, could you help out with that? Are there other comments or questions?
I'm not seeing any at this time, Barbara.
Correct. Going once? Well, I need to break from protocol a little bit here myself to make a comment, because I have one. I also support the decision to deny this petition, but I support it for slightly different reasons. I'd like to make it clear that I also understand and appreciate the amount of just work and thought and process that has gone on to trying to resolve the issue of how we can recover an endangered species like a wolf when it is occupying the same ground as its likely prey. We have spent thousands, if not many, many thousands of hours and a lot of money trying to figure that out. But I also have no problem with the fact that this petition's before us. I think it is an indicator that there are people that are involved or would like to be involved in this process that don't feel like they have a voice. And so they're using a perfectly appropriate legal means to try to have a voice. As far as I'm concerned, that is it. More voices, the better. But my vote on this is to deny the petition and, under the law, suggest an alternative. My alternative is based on the fact that I believe we've missed a step here. We have talked as a commission and as a wolf committee quite a bit since I've been on the commission about what our role is in wolf recovery and in setting the parameters of some of these processes by which we use to try to get to wolf recovery. And this petition skips us. It goes straight from, well, our process is the WAG, goes to the director, all of the regional staff. And now we may basically hop over us and go straight to rulemaking. My belief, and has been for quite a while, that we need to get more involved. And I think we need to listen to some of the people who feel like they aren't being heard. We probably need to look at our processes pretty closely and at least understand them before we decide if we're going to enter into rulemaking at all. And we need to talk to, I believe that we need to spend some time talking to the sides of these issues and hear for ourselves, straight from the horse's mouth, what we need to be paying attention to. I think that we should suspend work on our post-recovery plan for now and focus our attention not just on conflict, because conflict is part of another process which is called recovery, and I'm not particularly satisfied that we're sure that wolves are recovering as they should in this state. It's obvious that they're getting to have more numbers, but we don't know why they're not dispersing to the south and to the west. And I believe that there's people in this state who do have ideas about things like that that would like to talk to us about it. So I'd like to have a science presentation. I'd like to compare our lethal protocol with Oregon's. It's been said over and over that Oregon's kind of got this figured out. I don't know the differences. I don't know the difference between us and Oregon. I don't know the difference exactly between us and the rules that are proposed. So my point in all of this is that even though it seems like a lot of work, and it will be a lot of work, I think we need to pay some attention to this before we go straight to rulemaking. I've got probably 5 pages of notes of things I wanted to say and suggest, but we're already an hour into this meeting, so we got to get going. So I will also be voting to deny, but I will be voting to deny and suggest an alternative. Are there any other? Okay, Bob's got his hand up. Go ahead, Commissioner Kehoe. I think you're muted.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Appreciate your comments and Commissioner Thorburn's comments as well. I too will be voting in favor of the motion to deny the petition for rulemaking. I think the focus of my comments will be that in my view and in my experience in kind of very difficult policy, difficult decision making, particularly, and this lethal removal is the classic example of the need for flexibility in decision making. And because I think, as Donnie pointed out, every situation is unique. It's very difficult to kind of develop a set of rules that covers every situation. And I think when you go into rulemaking with a difficult decisions where there's so many different variables, what you end up doing is you end up putting yourself in a box. So just for an example, if we were to move forward with rulemaking, which would then have certain requirements, certain triggers, where then a decision would be made where you have to lethally remove a wolf. And my understanding is, and kind of in following many of these decisions that the director has made over the years, is that even if all of the protocol criteria are checked, the director, based on certain circumstances, chooses not to exercise lethal removal, chooses other alternatives. So if you were to go to rulemaking, that flexibility is gone. Every time you check the box, you shall remove a wolf. And I don't think that's appropriate. So that's one of the reasons why I'm going to be voting in favor of the motion to deny the petition. Thank you.
Commissioner Smith, your hand is up.
You're muted, Brad.
I'm sorry. All right now?
Yep.
Okay. A couple thoughts triggered by the last two comments. I will be voting against the rulemaking as well. And I think Commissioner Keogh makes a really strong point about the box scenario. And also Commissioner Baker, I think there's a lot of questions that are raised, that you raised, that I too want answers to. I do have concerns, though, even though I will vote in favor of not going forward. I do have concerns about the continual removal, lethal removal in certain segments of the state, in certain ranches. I understand, I appreciate Donnie's presentation, but I just want to go on record that it seems that a few names keep popping up repeatedly, and a few ranches keep popping up repeatedly. And I think that we have to continue to have deep discussions with those individual properties and individuals about their methods. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, I believe that Commissioner Carpenter and Commissioner Graybill have their hands up. Commissioner Carpenter.
Yes, good morning. I'll be brief. I think the comments by the previous commissioners were well stated, all of them. I'm going to vote to deny the petition. But I do want to say that I do think that an opportunity to be more inclusive and to exchange views, perspectives, ideas with other people into the future is a very, very good thing. But having said that, I don't know how we're going to do that. That's going to require some work in itself to figure out how we're going to do that, and how big that is, et cetera. I guess simplistically to me, is what our staff does. We have an excellent staff. In the wildlife side, we have some people that know their business, and that includes the director on down. And we have to trust them. As a commission, we oversee what the department does, and primarily make sure the director does his job. And I can't speak for all of us, but I think I'm most pleased with the job they're doing on wolves. It's not perfect, but I don't know that anybody can get it perfect. So I'm going to vote to deny the petition, encourage the staff to continue doing the work that they are. We can all learn and engage and talk to other stakeholders into the future. And thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Graybill.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I really appreciate, again, Commissioner Kehoe's perspective on this. I believe that the petition creates a box that they may not fully appreciate, and it reduces our ability to respond to conflict in a manner that's to their benefit. I agree with the statements from other commissioners. The wolf issue is always something that we're seeking refinements. I would like to be able to hear alternatives. I think the petition is important in that it does point out some frustrations, and there are many on this particular issue. And I think, if anything, it gives us some guidance of areas that need to be considered. But again, I want to thank the people, particularly Commissioner Thornburn and Barbara Baker, other people that are on that committee. It's a very difficult, time-consuming job. And there's still work to be done on it, and I'll deny the petition because I think it would actually inhibit the work that's moving forward. Thank you.
Any further comments or questions?
Madam Vice Chair.
Commissioner McKaysey.
Yes, thank you, Madam Vice Chair, and appreciate all the discussion from the commissioners. I think this is a good way for the process to work here. I'd note that the petitioners have done some excellent work in putting this material together, and I agree with you, Madam Vice Chair, that they've raised a lot of good points here. In terms of some of the rationale that's out there, Commissioner Thorburn has done a very nice job of outlining some of it. You have made some good points as well. Commissioner Linville's not on the line. And the other day when we were all together in that public meeting, she mentioned a few other things that fit into what the pattern of rationale being put is, but added some more, and I was trying to remember some of that, but I would just note that she had some very good comments. They also made one feel like the best choice here is to deny the petition and think of another way to move forward. The petitioners want to get to somewhere, and I hope that maybe that there is a way to make some progress to achieve some of the things they want. I would agree completely with Commissioner Kehoe's position that our current process, not by rule, might have the adaptive flexibility to employ lessons learned as we move through the years and through the months, and maybe allow more progress to be made toward these goals than if we had a hard rule that if it wasn't achieved is open to a lawsuit from different sides. So I agree with that perspective. One thing you mentioned, Madam Vice Chair, was that these petitioners don't feel like they have a voice, and if or their voice isn't appropriately heard or something like that. And I thought that in our process that we would be encouraging all the voices to be heard, all the new ideas to be put on the table, and all of them to be judged in the best manner towards the goals that are in the Wolf Plan. So I'm in favor of your approach to think about this and think about ways to have our policy try to move forward in a better manner. And I know that's what the staff's been thinking too, but because of all those reasons, I'm in support of the motion to deny at this time.
Are there any other comments or questions or positions that we need to discuss before we take a vote? Okay, hearing none, all in